Malachi 3. Well, it's my experience that in this process of whatever it is that we're about begins in us, that God demands something, and that is that our lives be simplified. And because, you know, Harry's the prime example. Harry's always the worst case.
No.
But Harry was living
in this area.
Yeah. Harry had gotten used to a lifestyle which was always an illusion. He had no income. He was paying $1,100 a month in rent. He was paying $400 a month in a car payment. He was paying innumerable credit cards. And then all of a sudden, the rug got pulled out from under him. Because it wasn't that God did it in that context. It was just that he was living an illusion. The process that we're about costs you your life. And it costs us especially the illusions. And you know, bore you with the details, but for the first 2 years that I was a believer, I lived on $15 a week. And that was, you know, from the fall was more dramatic than I care to remember.
Our situations are so similar in that the stuff that I was doing, you know, I only had to make two or three deals a year. I only had to sell two or three films a year, and I could live very, very comfortable. But when I look back now, at what I did to sell those so-called deals and keep them together, and oh man, it wasn't pleasant when the things started getting ripped off me. But I can tell you, the greatest thing in the world is having all that stuff taken away. That big house and the nice clothes and the jewelry and the...
Well, I don't have any jewelry. I mean, all my jewelry is fake.
All I'm saying is, you know, he started out by saying a simplified lifestyle.
Propensity to the last I had a period of time of about a year and a half in which when I lost Ocean Resources, and then I went into a public relations kind of business, which was really lobbying and deal making, but which I'd been in before. But the whole idea, when I think about it, I'm reminded of, you know, like, the best way to describe it is one Harvard Business School says that the theory of management is that all you're supposed to do is keep the corks down. And in that deal-making environment, it's like, there's corks, there's 4,000 corks, and they're all pumped, and you're like a wild person trying to, you know, just keep track of the corks. Well, that's not, first of all, it's not healthy. I don't know what the answer is. All I know is that the experiences that you're going through, don't be surprised if, I mean, debt is the money thing. God didn't give a fuck about that.
What is it you said about debt and indebtedness, Sunday?
what did I say about it? I said it was stealing. Well, remember, everything in the world is trying to pull you away from the simplicity, including your mind, including all of the ideas of schemes and stuff. But I'm just saying that you know, he wants us to owe no man anything. I mean, if we owe, then when we move through life, the owing becomes it becomes a string that ties us, or it's not a string, it's a chain that ties us to the Gentile system, to the Gentile world. And as these chains are broken, then we're free from, you know, the first time in our lives. So I don't know what to do. I mean, I don't have any answers, obviously, but all I know is don't be surprised at that process that's going on, because he's moving in and through your life to simplify it so that you can move in an arena of peace. There isn't a, I mean, God didn't care what you do. I mean, whether it's deal making or anything else, it's just that it's how your mind responds to it that he cares about. And, but, you know, we'll just pray that that'll be resolved quickly. Anybody else? Malachi 3, verse 1. This is the catch-up prophet, because we were supposed to, this is the leftover readings stuff thingies.
Wonder how Malachi feels about
what?
Yeah.
Well, he's the last guy.
How Malachi feels about that?
Malachi's the last guy.
He's kind of left over.
Malachi was written about 430 years before Christ. Malachi, the book of Malachi, ends with a curse.
I heard you want to hear that.
And it's the curse. It's the curse that we talked about last night, that the day is far spent. This was in the last parts of the day, the spiritual day, and the day is far spent. And it ends at sunset. The curse is the cross. So it talks now about John the Baptist being sent as a messenger in the wilderness. But it's every preacher is what he's talking about here, as we've talked about. Every time that you're in a wilderness position, then God sends a messenger before him, which proclaims the way. Doesn't make any sense if you're not in wilderness, if you're not in dryness, if you're not in need, if you're not in the desert. If you still have hope, none of this stuff means anything.
It's about 400 years between Malachi and Christ.
So, let's read. John?
3:1.
Read the first five verses.
Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me. The Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in. Behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts. But who may abide the day of his coming? And who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire, like fuller's soap.
Okay. He has come suddenly to the temple, to all, you know, human race, as we've talked about. But it's when we come to understand that he has now come to reclaim the temple, and no one can stand. You can't coexist. Okay.
And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver. And he shall purify the sons of Levi.
Why silver?
Well, silver is just a it's used a lot, but silver is typical of the redemption, or it's typified. It's silver's tip. The typical meaning of silver, I think, and I'll have to think about this, but throughout the Torah and the Old Testament, is that it's the typified. It's the Son of Man. I mean, it's Christ and his as Redeemer.
What was it in the temple?
In the temple, tabernacle. In the tabernacle, it was the sockets upon which the tabernacle had to touch. It could never touch the ground. It had to touch the silver socket. Then that silver socket is what touched the ground. So the gold never touched the ground. It had to be interfaced with silver. Mm-hmm. The gold is Christ in his glory.
Isn't there an interface between silver and blood?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's redemption. That's the redemption.
Mm-hmm. But it goes on here and talks about gold and silver both.
I don't know when you were talking, all of a sudden, start crying. You know, just, I don't know why. Just the funniest thing, we started reading this, and I don't know that. Wasn't any understanding, just.
There was deep understanding.
Yeah.
Okay.
He shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. Then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be pleasant unto the Lord, as in the days of old and as in former years. And I will come near to you to judgment, and I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers and against the adulterers and against false swearers and against those that oppress the hireling and his wages, the widow and the fatherless, and that turn aside the stranger from his right, and fear not me, saith the Lord of hosts.
Okay. You know, it's hard to understand how can I say this? Our mind thinks about things in a utilitarian way. We make stuff as human beings, and what we make is utilitarian, and it's normally for one. It just does one thing. You know, a coffee maker makes coffee, a telephone you talk to. And then we're surprised because it's fortuitous when it makes more than one thing. And then we find out that, wow, this is something else. Something else can be done with this, and it's a neat feeling. But when God makes something, everything that God makes has an infinite number of uses. And there's a this Andrew Jukes book that John gave me had an example about like you know, take anything, air, you know.
Wood.
Air is you know, I mean it's everything. I mean it's what causes weather, it's what causes life to you, it's the interchange which causes life to plants. It's the thing which causes fire to burn. It's the vehicle for birds. I mean, you know, ad nauseum. We could go on and on in a litany of everything that air is used for, or everything that wood is used for, or everything that. But the key to understanding the scriptures is to understand that when God makes something, there's a multiplicity of uses. But when our mind reads the Bible, we still think in this the singularity or the unit that we think in terms of. You're right. If he said this, then this is what it means. Mm-hmm. God said it. I believe it, and that settles it. Yeah, with the mind of a Gentile. But when we see the depths of what each of these scriptures mean, and the multiplicity of uses of each of these scriptures, then there's the veil is taken off of our eyes. And it, you know, we're starting to see it. We saw that the stories in the book of Genesis really revealed Christ in you and all its different things. We saw that the mystery of the Exodus revealed your departure from the world and all of its systems. And as we get deeper into the law and into the prophets, we'll see, we're just scratching the surface. I mean, we haven't even started yet. And I want you to be able to understand that while it is, it's in one kind of a terrible way of looking at it, when we study the Torah and the prophets, what we're doing is taking Christ apart.
It's rightly dividing the word
right.
The same way that cut up the sacrifice.
That's right. We're taking Christ apart that we might inspect the sacrifice. Remember now that when remember the Passover sacrifice. The Passover sacrifice, the first thing we had to do with that sacrifice, 4 days before the day of Passover, we had to go, first of all, we had to get a lamb, and we had to have bunches of lambs. So lambs had to come from somewhere. But then we had to take a lamb, and we had to look and make sure there was no blemishes on him, and that he was, he's a nice lamb. He had to be a nice lamb for our purposes. I mean, he had to meet our need. He had to meet some legal needs, too, but we had to think of him as a nice lamb. Okay, then the lamb was slain, and then it was cut open, and it was skinned, and its internal organs were carefully examined by the priest, the one particular order of priests, to make sure that the sacrifice met the demands. Well, that's what we do when we, in one real sense, when we are studying the scriptures. If you take Christ as the Lamb of God, or the Goat of God, or I don't care, one of the sacrifices, he's all of them, and we begin to cut him up, and we analyze it, and look, and see, and it goes all the way down to the point of bone and marrow. We'll even split the bone and investigate the marrow. And so... That's why it's sometimes difficult in teaching or speaking, because I may be talking to you about examining the kidneys and your mind is out looking at the wool. Do you understand what I'm saying?
There seems to be a discrepancy.
And they're right.
Talking about the same
right.
thing.
Right.
Oneness.
And I'm sitting here thinking that these little animal minds that we pride ourselves in are able to take apart the lamb and inspect parts of it for specific purposes. However, no way are we capable of putting the lamb together.
Amen.
And only looking at one dimension, maybe if we're really on a particular night, two dimensions, yeah. And if a miracle occurs, three dimensions, but not all dimensions.
All right. But I want One of my jobs is, first of all, you know, we've talked before that my role as a teacher is to spiritualize the natural so that you see everything in its spiritual reality. But another role is to take and cut apart the lamb. Now, the problem with doing that is in cutting apart the lamb, you're being cut apart.
Yeah, when you were saying that, it sounded so terrible until you... But when you said that's what happened to priests, that was what they were meant to do. And when you first said it, you know, cutting up the lamb, it just sounded... inspecting the parts of Jesus, I mean, it just sounded so terrible to... You know, but then when you talk... Even if it's... I mean, it's bloody and everything, but it's part of the necessary thing, and it doesn't sound wrong.
It's the duty of the priesthood, and we are a nation of priests.
John said something Thursday night that really hit me this afternoon. And it's when we were talking about the scapegoat, about how the scapegoat was sent out into the wilderness and carried away the sin, and if that was accepted, then the ribbon turned white, and et cetera, et cetera. But what he said that night was, well, it's almost as if Azazel had to accept the lamb, the sacrifice, the goat. And that really hit me this afternoon, and I think that's what we're talking about right now. That in a very real sense, Azazel sits here and inspects the sacrifice and decides whether or not to accept it.
Well, I don't know about that.
It's our minds that are accepting, that are inspecting it piece by piece by piece to see if it fits.
I'll have to think about that one. But what I want you to, what I want to do is when we, and we haven't, again, I promise you, we haven't even scratched the surface. It's like, I mean, every time I, when I get in deep into the stuff, and I think about teaching it, and I think about it being received, I get scared because there's no way that, I mean, we are so far from, we are so far from apprehending truth that it's mind-blowing. And it's only by grace that we can continue. Now, part of the process then is to every time, and that's why it sometimes seems uncomfortable to you, because part of the process, what makes your old self comfortable is when you can have a stand. And you can say, it means this. And then you can very conveniently use the scriptures in a utilitarian way to meet your own evil ends. You don't think they're evil, but they're self-seeking. And that's, you know, I've noticed in our conversations, the better we get to know each other, the more apparent it is how subtly we justify ourselves. And that'll continue until the knife divides and cuts up the bone and the marrow. But all I want us to be, and I say this for one reason, I want us to have the freedom, if I see you and in your conversation, you're simply walking around justifying yourself, I'm going to have the freedom to take a knife to you and you to me if we are going to ever move on as a body.
Amen. Mm-hmm. Amen.
And it's so subtle. And don't think the knife is, don't, you can't take it personal. If you ever take it personal, then, man, you're going to be wiped out. Everybody understand what I'm talking about?
And at the same time, I'm remembering the thing about that which I would have apprehended me. And I'm thinking about the trick, and I'm thinking about line by line, and et cetera, and fall back and be snared, that this subtle self-justification and all the crap that we just talked about, that will continue. It will continue until the trap is sprung, until we are apprehended.
Well, until, that's the reason it keyed all this in me, is until he suddenly fills the temple.
Mm-hmm. All the little one-dimensional, it's almost like back to when we were reading about the tabernacle, about how it finally reared itself up. We look at the pins and we look at the things and the pieces and the boards, but suddenly a breath of wind.
Right.
And who can abide the day?
Who can abide the day of his coming?
I don't know what that means.
It means to abide, who can continue. And the word coming there just means presence. You got to keep that in mind, whenever, because otherwise you're getting these weird theologies about dispensationalism. Who can abide the day of his presence? When you see his presence, when you truly see what it means to see him, you're wiped out. That's what it means. We lost our Santa.
She couldn't take it. She couldn't take it.
Well, in verse 5, I will come near you to judgment. I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers. Now, there's no sorcerers here.
Right.
John's not a sorcerer, that's for sure. What's a sorcerer? A sorcerer is one who mixes things together for an end result.
Oh, that's wild. Rather than taking things as
a diviner,
as they were given,
right.
He mixes
things together for an end result. Now, you can mix God's stuff together.
Folly and fear.
You can mix, and you can try, you can do all these things, and what you're trying to do is you're trying to stop the sacrificial knife. But you do it in the name of understanding. We're concentrating right now on what sorcery is in the spirit. I mean, and with regard to in here, every one of you is a constant sorcerer in the world. But you understand what I'm talking about sorcery?
Say it again. I'll explain it.
Okay, sorcery, and it's a word that means this. It means mixing things together so that you, I mean, if you make a cake, you're a sorcerer. I mean, that's the kind of thing. You take different things and you mix them together so that you get desired result.
You get something new out of a mixture that's not for your own purpose or something.
Right, but what it is, in the spirit, it's trying to learn line upon line. Mm-hmm. Trying to see line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little.
Here a doctrine, there a doctrine to make me a right person.
That's right. Or not even here a doctrine, there a doctrine. Here a piece of this doctrine, and there a piece of that doctrine.
Whatever's convenient.
Yeah.
Just to make you feel better.
Justification.
It's the end result is self-justification, so you stop the process so you have a place to stand. That's the result of all this stuff. And you do it you do it very righteously. You do it in the name of understanding. You're not going to understand by being a sorcerer. You're going to understand by obeying the light that you have. That's why divining is, it's a different thing in the spirit. Sorcery is one thing, divining is another thing. Divining the times and the astrologers and the monthly stargazers. Divining the times is trying to take you out of the moment of dependence. Well, you know what adultery is. It's going to some place other than God for your sustenance. It's whoredom.
It's mixing too.
And against false swears. No, and then none of you are false swears.
Mm-hmm. Swears are false.
Do you understand that every time you make a plan, you're a false swearer in God's eyes?
I don't understand that.
Because you have an end objective and you're swearing to get there.
There's no way to know
where
you...
You don't have any idea what's going to happen the next second.
Yeah.
But you've organized in swearing, you've forsworn yourself to take these steps to get to that end objective. In the spirit, every idea and opinion you have is false swearing. Okay. Who oppresses the hireling and his wages, the widow and the fatherless, and turn aside the stranger from his right? Well, anyway, he's a swift witness against this. That's why it's so critical that we understand what Christ said when he said, "You are they that have continued with me in my temptation." Because his temptation is never to lean on his own arm of understanding, never to be a sorcerer.
Well, something about what she just said made me feel real. Just, you know, it just seems like it takes pressure off.
Takes all the pressure off.
Yeah. It was neat.
Isn't part of the meaning of being perfect, isn't part of it be what you're intended to be, fulfill your destiny, be fully?
No. There's two concepts. One is, every man must bear his own burden. That is, every man will fulfill his own office, our own position. But be perfect means, in the arena that God has placed you in. I mean, when you stop and think, what you could have been, and when you could have been born, and where you could have been born.
In Turks.
It's infinite, but God in his wisdom has established the bounds of your habitation. And in that boundary is the propensity, the capability for you to be fully perfected simply by not leaning on your own number of understanding as you walk through it. And there's the promises, he will not put on anything more than you can bear in that environment, because you're just as, you know, if a fingernail had to go through what the cell of the stomach wall.
Yeah, or the bottom of your foot.
Right. I mean, it couldn't happen. But you are where you're supposed to be. There are some of you that if you had to have gone through what I've gone through since I've been a believer, you'd have left. And vice versa, probably.
Yeah, if you hadn't gone through what you've gone through, you would have died.
Right. Or if I, right, whatever it is.
More children would have been right.
No, whatever the process is, it's uniquely yours, and you have been empowered for that.
I wonder what is the lesson that I'm to learn from Chris.
Don't lean on your own arm of understanding. Never. There's no lesson to be learned. Forget that idea.
We talked about that last time.
You're not supposed to learn anything. It's not happening to Joanna. That's the mistake. That's why you try to get resolution after the flesh. You think, well, I need to learn something from this. You're not supposed to learn anything. You're supposed to be perfected by the antagonism of that moment. And that's the process. And it's sure, it's perfect, it's exactly as it should be. And as that concept penetrates your being, you know, then each one of us here have a different perspective of what it means to be a believer, a different bound of habitation, a different environment, a different genetic background, a different environmental background. But it's perfect. As we've said so many times, all of your whole genetic history, including all of your forefathers and all of the experience of them and of you, are a pyramid. And you're sitting on the pinnacle of the pyramid. You're the reason all of your forefathers ever existed. No matter how arrogant that sounds. Everything that happened to them happened so that you could be here now. So that you could see. So that your own unique experience would be perfect. Capisce?
Did Christ go through, since Christ is the head of the body, and we're just members in particular, did he go through everything that the whole body of Christ?
No, it says fill up the afflictions.
You said something
we're
one
lacking.
Night about he had the hereditary potential to be the greatest in anything. I find it hard to believe.
Right, yeah.
I mean, he could have been super strong man. He could have been, you know, that doesn't compute. I can't imagine.
Why did you say that? I don't remember that.
Because hereditarily, to do one thing, you'd have to be completely different.
But you forgot his key heredity was the Son of God.
Yeah. But you can't overcome physical, you know.
He would have changed it if it necessary. I mean, whatever, he had the potential.
Oh, if he wanted to
yes.
do it? Oh, okay.
Yeah, God wanted him to do anything.
Well, no, but no, it's not, forget God for a minute. Christ, after the flesh, had the potential to be anything he wanted to be.
Just as Adam had all the, Adam was able to do Adam, all the things that he was.
Right, Adam was the best, Adam was the best there ever was. It's been downhill ever since.
Okay, so he was the first Adam, and what?
And Christ had the same potential?
Much more. What Christ emptied himself of was equality with God in all its power.
So what he actually chose to do was just be the
moment
the
of dependence.
Physical son of.
No, what he chose to be was in every moment to be dependent on the Father.
Amen.
But he didn't choose to be a strong man. And
no,
he
just chose every moment to be dependent on the Father. All the way from, you know, and it really only counted from one sense, from the point of baptism, but from the baptism until the cross, until his descent, he never once said, okay, I'm going to do this. He moved through life in that moment of dependence. And I'm talking about a mathematical moment, not a time moment.
But in terms of going through everything in time now, isn't he going through being a strong man in his form as Ed?
Well, that's your mission, your function in the body is to fill up the affliction. And the affliction just means the thlespis, the testing.
So there wasn't enough testing with Christ because he was just.
He was the head.
So he didn't experience everything we. Do we fill up the affliction by
but he is in you.
Yeah. So out of time.
But my point to you is this. Look, it's just like cloning. You know, the if I take this one cell of my body, it has the DNA structure to be able to theoretically produce
God forbid, but an exact ovum. Which it would include all the other things
right.
that he didn't take it out of, even though he just took it out of one little
right.
cell.
It includes everything, even though he took it out of one cell. Now that's the same, that's why it's so, as we go deeper and deeper into this heart of God, and the understanding of, and all of that is revealed in here, by the way. As we go deeper and deeper and deeper, then we'll see that. And the essence of it is, I got to tell you this over and over again, to the mind, to the real you, every time we see this, its end result is one singular fact, your comfort. Now sometimes what I say doesn't sound too comfortable because it comes against an idolatry, an idol. But the end result of it is comfort and joy. Peace?
Kind of.
You were going to say something?
I was thinking about something Gary and Judy and Pam and I talked about on the way to Bible study about. I thought about, all these people like Billy Graham or Hitler or you or.
Guys like that.
Guys like that.
Right in there with Hitler and Billy Graham.
What does that mean? You know that crowd.
Hitler and Billy Graham have a lot.
Mussolini, that crowd.
Mussolini.
No, all these people, the people who had this great charismatic, those guys had, it seemed like, I thought about the gifts and calling of God are given without repentance, and at some point they had the same potential, they could have been a prophet for God, and many may have even started out, with that in their mind, and I was thinking of that in regards to what each one of us we start out in it, and we may wind up being super this or that, but there is a place where the flip side of the coin is in the edification of the body.
Wow. Anybody else? Malachi. How did we get off of all this stuff?
And sorcery. 1-5.
Oh, sorcery, that's right.
I started mixing a bunch of stuff together.
He needs to be hit.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
But for no particular purpose.
Not purposely. Just randomly mixing stuff together. That's what you call a dumb sorcery. That's what you call a
He thinks maybe it'll come out to be a cake. He hopes it comes out to be
it's
a cake.
It's an upside down cake.
The dump cake.
Well, let me read again. Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me.
Read the whole thing.
And the Lord whom ye seek.
No, I
didn't read it good enough.
You read it good.
Because Ed's just got here.
Oh, okay.
The Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant whom ye delight in. Behold, he shall come, saith the Lord of hosts. But who may abide the day of his coming? And who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire, and like fuller's soap. And he shall sit as a refiner, and purifier of silver. And he shall purify the sons of Levi, and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. Then shall the offering of Judah and Jerusalem be pleasant unto the Lord, as in the days of old, as in the former years. And I will come near to you in judgment, to judgment, and I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers, against the adulterers, and against false swearers, and against those that oppress the hireling in his wages, the widow and the fatherless, and to turn aside the stranger from his right, and fear not me, saith the Lord of hosts. For I am the Lord, I change not. Therefore, ye sons of Jacob, are not consumed. Do you understand that?
Like his his purpose is such that even when things seem to get weird and everything's strange, that the seed was going to come forth from all these sons of Jacob.
Well, but I mean, it's
in us, it's the same way. That the seed's going to come forth even when we're often weird.
Okay. Even from the days of your fathers, you are gone away from mine ordinances, and have not kept them. Return unto me, and I will return unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. But you said, wherein shall we return? Now, the way that's said is that, oh, I didn't know I'd left you.
Yeah.
You know, I've been good. I've been coming to Bible study all these years. Wherein shall we return? What do you mean? And he goes on. Will a man rob God? Now think about that a minute.
God? Would a man willfully rob God?
Would a man willfully rob God?
Not if he's small.
Yet, you have robbed me. But you say, wherein have we robbed thee? This is in tithes and offerings. Do you know how many tithes there are in the scriptures?
You mean how many times it says it?
No.
How many different tithes?
Yeah.
How many?
Three.
Ten.
Oh. Be all
it's three different tithes.
One for each one of the Trinity?
No. We've only talked about one of the tithes, and yet that's too much for you. Will a man rob God? No, not if he's smart. Wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse. For you have robbed me, even this whole nation or this whole people. Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house, and prove or test me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts. If I will not open you the windows of heaven, and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. Now,
we don't believe. Listen, 11.
And I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, and he shall not destroy the fruit of your ground, neither shall your vine cast her fruit before the time in the field, saith the Lord of hosts. And all nations shall call you blessed, for you shall be a delightsome land, saith the Lord of hosts. It's like if we could see in this description. Right above each of your heads there is a trap door. But the only way you can open that trap door, which is humongous,
it's full of good times.
It's full of everything that you could desire. It's full of every need. It meets every need that you could imagine. It's every physical, spiritual, mental need, so that if that trap door is opened, every mental, every psychological, every physical, everything is there. But it's an interesting trapdoor, and that it's tied to a little teeny trapdoor below your feet. And when you open, you have to open that trapdoor down there, and then it opens a big one.
Yeah, but how many are you going to make it through that hole that you fall through?
You're not going to fall through. You're not going to fall through. There's nothing. There's no place to fall. You're in solid ground. The trapdoor analogy only is that it pours out to meet the need around you. But there's six different or seven different kinds of offerings. And we've talked about tithes. But when you get to the offerings, there's the heave offering, the peace offering, the sin offering, all the offerings that we'll get to. All of these offerings, and all of the meat offering and the drink offering, all of these offerings are represented and fulfilled when you present yourself the living sacrifice. In that opening of that, in this case, the trapdoor is sustenance. It's what you receive. 10% of the first tithe is 10% of all your increase. Whatever it is that you have increased, whether it's fruit trees or lambs or money, but 10% of all of that goes automatically. Now, as we've talked about, you do that anyway, but you're tithing to the wrong God. And God says, I'm jealous. But the other part, now we have two other tithes, which we'll get into now in Leviticus. But they're all tied to this trapdoor above you that has everything in the universe. And you're to bring your tithe to the storehouse. Where is the storehouse? It's the place that you're fed. It's not going to do you one whittle of good to say you're tithing. Well, it's like people used to when they came in. Well, I'm tithing to this church over here. Well, that's bullshit. Or I'm tithing over there. Or part of my tithe is going to the widows over here. Or part of my tithe is meeting this need. No! The tithe goes to the place that you're fed. Only and exclusively. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the first tithe. And we'll talk about the second and about the third. And each one of those tithes now is tied to this humongous thing that all the gold in the world, if that's what you want, all of the sex in the world, all of the sexual fulfillment, all of it meets every need that you can possibly dream about.
I was thinking about the hours in the week. We talked about this before, but the hours in the week are about 170 hours a week. Is that right?
163.
And I was thinking about just a tenth of that, even if it was just a tenth of your waking hours, it would be like 10 or 15, 17 hours a week of meeting other people's needs. And I was just thinking about, you know, if we, it probably would work out that way if we just met the need that came to us, you know, on a daily basis. It, you know, you wouldn't have to think about meeting needs 17 hours a week. Mm-hmm. You know, that's right. Dumb, but, you know, just...
Yeah, it's structured that way. I mean, the bounds of your habitation are structured that way.
So you'll be able to do right. All these things.
We get a time code.
But... the offering, all of it is fulfilled if you have truly presented yourself as a living sacrifice. Only if you abandon yourself. Only if you bubble forth. Only in spontaneity. It's what's there, and it doesn't matter. It's not your business to define the condition of it. You know, we've said it so often. If it's a question, you speak it. If it's a doubt, you speak it. If it's fear, you speak. Whatever it is, it's these burn offerings are all manifested mystically in the abandonment and the bubbling forth of each one of you.
I can't even be thankful enough. You know, I can sit here at night and it's like everything is just like pouring over me.
Yeah, you get
and for whatever reason, you know, that caused me to be open, I think, you know, why can I sit here tonight and I just want to drink it in and I hear and I can see that I've robbed God, you know. I can see all that you're talking about, and yet it's the total difference that within me of not
condemning
you, of not condemning you or anybody else, even if it's timed, you know. And I'm thankful for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Verse 13. Your words have been stout against me. That's pretty heavy duty. Your words have been stout. Now.
Is that
like
complaining, or what? Which words?
Every word you speak, every thought you think. But it's like...
I wasn't reading ahead.
It's like every time you're in a position of anything other than joy, perfect joy, it's your words are stout against him.
Or if you're in a position to give and you hold back, you're saying it's a vain thing to serve God because he won't meet your needs somehow. If you give, he won't get.
Right. Okay. Your words have been stout against me, saith the Lord. Yet you say, what have we spoken so much against thee? You have said, it is vain to serve God. Nobody's ever said that.
In word or deed.
How many times today did you say it? it's interesting what it's tied to here, and we'll see some a neat twist. And what profit is it that we have kept his ordinance, and that we have walked mournfully before the Lord of hosts? And now we call the proud happy. And yea, they that work wickedness are set up. Yea, they that tempt God are even delivered. How do we do that? Is that what we say? Do we call the proud happy? Every time you envy somebody, you're calling the proud happy.
Yeah, these guys have it all. It's funny, 11 and 15. There's two ways to the end of your desires.
Right. Okay. Then, they that feared the Lord spoke often one to another. And the Lord hearkened and heard it. And a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and had thought upon his name. Now, do you understand? To think upon his name doesn't mean that you think about and sit around and think about God stuff all day, as you would, you know, when you read the Bible. Or to think upon his name means to see him in everything. That he is the source of all thought. That you never once, ever again, calculate without God.
I don't quite understand the expression, fear the Lord. I hear that a lot, and I don't really know what it means.
Well, the famous one is that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And then it goes on to say that in another place that wisdom is justified of her children. What is to fear the Lord means in you and us is to totally, the manifestation of the fear of the Lord in you is to totally distrust anything else. Does that compute?
Somewhat. My question is about the word fear, which my only definition for it is fright.
It's a good one.
Does that mean that if you're frightened of the Lord? Because that's not really what I feel. he doesn't seem like a boogeyman to me or anything.
I think it's a thing of contrast. It's like if you would serve man before you would serve God, then you're more fearful of what man can do to you than what God can do to you.
Well, see, that seems to suggest all the wrong reasons for serving God. I mean, like, serve me or else, you know, that doesn't really help you. It doesn't seem... See, I don't understand that word fear. You know, to me it seems like safety and protection and love and good stuff, you know. I don't really feel like... I mean, if God's saying...
Let's go.
Like,
go.
How can you take refuge in something you fear?
Let's finish this, and then we'll go to something that'll speak to that. Okay. And they shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spareth his own son that serveth him. Then shall you return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serveth God and him that serveth him not, or, in other words, saying it, that him that serveth himself. Now, what?
Well, that may then shall you return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serveth God, him that serveth him not.
Well, it means that the discerning process,
God, and
The return doesn't mean to go somewhere. It means it's the word shuv. You shall repent. Yeah. And at that point, you shall discern. Now, what?
I,
I'm getting a kick out of this picture of a book of remembrance.
Well, you understand that that's why it's read in this sea. It's Yom Kippur. It's the Rosh Hashanah. See, this is the reading for Rosh Hashanah.
Yes.
Malachi was. And it's the book of remembrance is the reason, the end result of why it's
of
the three books that are spread before him.
I keep thinking about God remembered Noah, the right thing at the right time and exactly the right way.
Okay, Hebrews 8. Now let's go to 10. Hebrews 10, verse 19. No, 16. This is the covenant that I will make with them after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their hearts, and in their minds will I write them. And their sin and iniquity will I remember no more. Now a remission of these is, there is no more offering for sin. Having therefore, brethren, boldness to enter into the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he hath consecrated for us through the veil, that is to say, his flesh. And having high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart, in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience, and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. Let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, so much the more as you see the day approaching. For if we sin willfully, after that we have received the knowledge of the truth, there remaineth no more sacrifice for sins, but a certain fearful looking for of judgment and fiery indignation which shall devour the adversaries. He that despised Moses' law died without mercy under two or three witnesses. Of how much sore punishment suppose ye shall be thought worthy, shall he be thought worthy who hath trodden under foot the Son of God, and hath counted the blood of the covenant wherewith he was sanctified an unholy thing, and hath done despite unto the Spirit of grace. For we know him that hath said, Vengeance belongeth unto me, and I will recompense, saith the Lord. And again the Lord shall judge his people. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. But call to remembrance the former days in which, after you were illuminated, you endured a great fight of afflictions, partly while you were made a gazing stock, partly both by reproaches and afflictions, and partly while you became companions of them that were so used. For you had compassion of me in my bonds, and took joyfully the spoiling of your goods, knowing in yourselves that you have in heaven a better and enduring substance. Cast not away, therefore, your confidence, which hath great recompense of reward. For you have need of patience, that after you have done the will of God, you might receive the promise. For yet a little while, and he that shall come will come, and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by his faith, or by faith. But if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. But we are not of them who draw back into perdition, but of them that believe to the saving of the soul. The only way that the nation of Israel left Egypt was because they knew the terror of God. They saw the 10 plagues. The only way you will leave Egypt, the world, in your mind, and you're giving breath to it, is to know the terror of God. Capisce? And that terror and fear, what?
Haven't we all done this? It seems like we've all sinned willfully after the knowledge of the truth and all that kind of stuff.
I'm not going to, let's concentrate on the fear aspect a minute. The only way you can know to leave Egypt is to know that is to know the terror of God.
So are you saying that the motivation is like, I mean, see, to me it feels like what I experience is the drawing near out of desire to draw near, not out of fear of what's going to happen if I don't.
Well, that's fine.
It just doesn't quite fit right, you know?
Well, but that's fine. It's the same end result. And this is, this fear business is tied to leaven in an interesting way. Let me read it. In the meantime, when they were gathered together, an innumerable multitude of people, insomuch that they trod upon one another, he began to say unto his disciples, first of all, beware ye of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. For there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed, neither hid that shall not be known. Therefore, whatsoever you have spoken in darkness shall be heard in the light, and that which you have spoken in the ear in closets shall be proclaimed upon the housetops. And I say unto you, my friends, be not afraid of them that kill the body, and after that have no more that they can do. But I will forewarn you whom ye shall fear. Fear him which after he hath killed hath power to cast into Gehenna. Yea, I say unto you, fear him. Okay, that's the predicate. And then he goes on to say, are not five sparrows sold for 2 farthings, and not one of them is forgotten before God? But even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. So he tells, first of all, he says in one sentence, says fear. And the next sentence, he says, don't fear. How can that be?
Well, he said, when you talk about faith, I mean, the evidence of fearing God is dependence.
That's right. The process, the evidence of the fear of God is the acceptance of the cross. After the cross, when the cross is no longer an offense to you, then you have nothing to fear.
But it can't come without the fear.
That's right.
Fear has this kind of a foundation that's laid to bring you to this other place.
But it's speaking to the two identities. It's speaking to the independent, the totally independent, self-willed, self-gathering, self-seeking identity, and it says fear.
He has every good reason to fear.
Right.
Okay, well, see, a lot of the references, it seems to be talking to the believers. It says fear God. And, you know, that's what made me question that just now.
Well, that's
I don't know, I might not have an accurate, I may have a, you know, a misconception about what God is or something, because I've never thought of God as anything to fear.
Delivers you. The fear is really there to deliver you into the opposite of it.
Well, you know? There's no question that it's possible that you have a misconception. Because
that's always a viable option.
Right? Yeah.
I'm
not going to try to explain it to you. All I can do is ask you to pray that the fear of God would be revealed to you. Yeah. I had the same struggle as you about the fear business, and I did. I asked him to reveal unto me the fear of God, and the horror of great darkness came upon me. But if that's your hunger, you have to have it satisfied. So.
Well, I don't know if that's my hunger, but I don't understand that kind of terminology. Because the way I see God and God in my life is like if you're on the dark streets and you know if you can get to that street lamp, you'll be safe. And so you're running for that street lamp. You don't fear it. That's where you want to be most of all.
Yeah, but you...
And if, that's how if, I see God.
If everything was, you know, if there was no reason to need a street lamp, in other words, if that darkness wasn't there,
then you would never ever even go over there. And part of what it's talking about is the darkness is there to, you know, to make the light stand out like that. But it's all God. You know, God's in the whole thing. And, you know, there's something that was going on as far as, you know, you didn't want to go out in the darkness. And what happens when the fear of the Lord comes, you say, I don't want to go that way. Because, you know, there's nuclear explosions going on, you know, off of this path. You know, I don't want to go out there. That's the fear of the Lord.
Let me say two things. One is, I've said before that you cannot know the fear of God, you cannot know the love of God until you know how intrinsically evil you are.
Yeah, to know that is to experience the fear.
And it's connected. You know, I rather than ask for the fear of God, let me ask each of you to do another thing. Let me ask each of you to pray that you would see yourself as God sees you. It came up in my head that I wanted everybody, and I didn't say it, but I wanted everybody here tonight to read Romans 7. But it doesn't appear to be related, but when you read it, I think you'll see what I mean, in connection with the fear of God. But I think it's especially true, and Harry said he experienced this last night. This incredible statement in Romans 7. It says, first of all, it says that every time I find a law, every time I try to do good, evil is present with me. But then he says this mysterious thing. He said, it is no more me sinning or doing it, but it's a sin principle which dwelleth in me. Now what the hell does that mean?
Seems like mind that, yeah, means that his point of view.
It means that once you see that it is no longer you that's doing anything, then, as Harry said, a switch is flipped.
You begin looking from the other viewpoint rather than the
right. You're all of a sudden it's no longer I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. then you can just sit back and look for a minute. You can play. You can be the observer, and you can watch this vessel run around and do stuff. And that's okay for a while. That's what I did for a long time, till I got to the, you know. Then I got tired of that. That's a dumb thing to do. I thought. I mean, but it was necessary to do it.
It's the seeing of being an alien in a bizarre land.
Yeah. But I would just, my only words of exhortation is just to be sort of with a casual, you know, step back and say, okay, what's this thing going to do next? Do you understand what I'm saying? Because I know you've experienced it, that you don't know, okay, what's this going on? Well, read Romans 7. Good. I hate Romans 5, it makes me sleepy. I hate Romans 6, it makes me hungry. I hate Romans 7, it makes me tired.
Holy,
I hate Romans 8, it makes me horny. I mean, you know.
Which one was that?
It's like the thing that always comes to our minds is what Joanna said earlier, is, you know, the idea of, well, what lesson am I supposed to learn from this? Well, you're not supposed to learn any lesson. You're perfect. You don't need any lessons. You're the child of the King. You don't need any lessons in anything. Well, what in the hell else? What's this going on? Well, this antagonist that's also dwelling in me is beating me around the bush. Okay. I'll let him beat me around the bush for a while because God's letting him do it to me. Okay. Once you see that it's God that's doing it, then all of a sudden the thing that has been beating you around the bush no longer has any power over you. But if you keep struggling against the struggler, and you think it's something that you're not supposed to experience,
like a Chinese finger trap,
then what will happen is that it'll continue there. It'll continue. And you'll change husbands, you'll change jobs, you'll change everything. Then you'll change locations, you'll go this way and that, because you think it's a strange thing that's happening to you. But once in that split second that you see that it's God that's causing the struggle, and you're perfect in the struggle, there's no longer a struggle. And all of a sudden you wake up the next morning, it's disappeared.
This thing he said is that's a perfect thing.
Chinese finger puzzle.
The idea of your, when you pull on it, you know, in real things, you pull out and you get about that far away, and you know, it grabs. Then you push it together and you don't do anything, it just sits there.
When you rest in it.
Yeah, it's like that thing that, you know, the sin in me, it's like it loses its power. It's like it doesn't ever go away. Because, you know, when you're at rest, it's still there. It's like you're still in this body, you know, walking around. But by resting, it has no power to do anything.
Right.
You know, it's not, it's immobilized. And
the meat's going to try.
It's not like you're, you know, it's not like you take it off and throw it away, because it's still there.
Yeah, we desire to be clothed upon with immortality, but...
Wait. Why not?
But you get the Chinese finger drill.
That
reminds me of the old saying, never wrestle with a pig. He'll like it and you both get dirty.
That's scary.
Yeah.